stopped. There we go. I had a streaming issue. There we go. We back. I'm going to start that over with. Yeah, welcome everybody. We are here with the founder of the West Coast Sound, the West Coast hip hop sound, Alonzo Williams, the founder of the discoverer of NWA and all of its members, along with so many icons and legends. And he has his own story. And the West Coast, we have our own story when it comes to this thing we call hip hop and West Coast music and black music in general. And right here, we have one of the key architects of that sound, of that groove, of that feeling. Mr. Alonzo, how you doing today, brother?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. Again, thank you, man, for joining us. This is really appreciated because, like I said, we have to understand as a people our history and the true founders and the people who make things happen, because when you get these movies, when you get these other stories, they like to cut people like you out and act as if it's insignificant, when you read people like you are the engine behind this big old thing that we see going on right now, that we know is hip hop, that we know is black American music. So again, I want to thank you for joining us and getting it going. I want to start off. So Alonzo, how did we get here? How did we start? When it came to you, we know that you started the early hip hop parties. Can you take us back to the years, I think we 1977, 1978, around that time, as you're putting together this thing that will eventually grow into hip hop? Can you talk to us about those late 70s?
You know, it's funny, man. We was talking about this the other day, me and Kelvin Anderson, VIP Long Beach, and we were just debating the origins of West Coast hip hop. You know, they just celebrated the 50th anniversary of hip hop year before last, in 2024. But we both agreed that West Coast hip hop had a different birth date. We're about three or four years later, 77, 78. I say 77 only because the two main people that, or actually the three main people that were in the dance promotion era of the 70s, before I go there, let me say this. Back in the 70s, 75, 76, 77, the big phenomenon for young black folks in America was throw dances. That's how we made our money. The schools did it. Then we take it off the campus, do after parties, and promote the noon dances, promote the after proms, a lot of stuff the schools wouldn't do. So promoters started doing it, and we are from that generation. And but we took it even further in 77, making it a full-time business for some of us. And we also evolved into the DJs and the promoters that brought in the hip-hop era. And I'm one of the, me and Unknown DJ are one of the two of the three surviving OG members. Everybody else did something else, whether in the real estate or insurance or whatever the case may be. But Unknown and myself and Roger Clayton from Uncle Jam's Army were the ones that came into the dance promotion last, but stayed into the hip hop, to transition in the hip hop. And we still are doing it. Roger passed in 2010, but me and Unknown are still doing our thing today. So that is why we say in 1977, when Roger and I got together and did Alpine Village, which is over in Torrance, that was our 1520 Sedgwick.
Mm-hmm.
That was doing our thing as guys who were the pivotal pillars of West Coast hip hop. I can't take it by myself. Now, my boys are bigger, don't get me wrong. I got the biggest and the best came out of my team, but we all started off with different missions, and this is how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, so Alpine Village, that's where I thought the 110 at that Torrance exit with the snow on the top.
Yes, sir. Yeah. We all started right there in 77. Me and Roger worked at a record distributor together and a place called Record Shack. And we both worked in the sales room. And one day he had the idea to do the Alpine Village. Well, he was a promoter. I'm the DJ. I'm already DJing. In fact, half the time I'm supposed to be on the phone selling records, I'm booking parties. As long as they saw you on the phone, this was before they had them phone monitoring systems. So as long as they saw you on the phone, They didn't really trip. I'm booking parties. I'm trying to make phone calls, you know, do what I can do. I sell a few records in the meantime. But that was where our initial movement for West Coast hip hop. And even then, we was playing funk music. Even then, we was playing disco sometimes. You know, we talking about 77, man. 1977, we were still in the throes of disco in a lot of eras, dude. People forget all about, people act like disco didn't exist because you don't know nothing about it. Most youngsters don't know nothing about disco. It's called EDM right now.
Yeah.
It's called EDM.
Or house. Okay?
Or house. Disco is the granddaddy to EDM and house. So if you were there, you know, but most people weren't there, so they don't know. So they don't understand the origin and the transitions that led up to where we are today.
Yeah, and then even with the word disco, a lot of people don't understand that disco was the term for party music.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was. It was party music.
It stood for discotheque, but I don't know where the tech came in at, but discotheque, it was like, it was the first early age of I'm going to say computer music, but it just was the era of instrumentation on another level. I think they were starting to blend some computer stuff in there. But because of the technology that was involved in disco, the lighting, the big sound systems, this is something that never happened before. This was a whole another genre where the DJ became the focal person of the dance floor as opposed to the band. Because before 77, most DJs played between bands.
Yes.
It was bands everywhere in L.A. It was 100 bands in L.A. And all the clubs had a band, and most of them had DJs, but the DJs only played in between the band's breaks. Mm-hmm. And disco put the focus on the DJ, and the DJs played all night long. So now you got DJs, you got lighting, the disco lighting with the flashing lights and the mirror balls and everything. It was more of a technical situation because now you got one person, or maybe two sometime, that's running the whole show. Because back then, you know, a DJ can plug your system into your mixer and your lights would flash and flicker based on the sound of the music, the beat of the music. So maybe that's why they got the tech part in it. I don't know nothing about that part per se, but that's just my perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, I always say, you know, that's been my thesis for a long time, that the disco is the party environment. But when it comes to hip hop, the music is the funk.
Music is the funk. Now, hip hop. Funk came out in 70, 75, 76, and it hit real hard. And about 74. I remember playing, maybe let me back up again. I'm playing at Peck Park in 75, 76, yeah. And that's when I first heard Cameo. Mm-hmm. At Rigor Mortis.
Oh, yeah, and, Rigor Mortis.
You know, Cameo, Slave. Slide, all that shit, man. That was the height of the early ages of funk. Although James Brown had been funky for a long time, and all these guys pretty much come from the James Brown groove, but it was a different kind of groove when Slave and Cameo hit. The groove was still funky. It just got a little bit more vocal, got a little bit more, had more backgrounds. It wasn't just one person in a groove. You know, James Brown was like one man in the groove in the horns. Well, with Slave and Cameo, you got all that, and then that was the basis for hip hop in the very beginning.
Yeah.
Everybody was there for all them old ass James Brown, Slave, Parliament Funkadelic records to get what you got, the first stages of hip hop.
Yeah. Question, because they always, you know, I want to clarify this. I had an issue, Chuck D had an issue with something I said when I said this. I said that hip hop had, even though we give New York credit for the genesis, each and every city had its own way of growing the sound. So yeah. When we're talking about early 70s, at that point, had you ever heard of Kool Herc at that time?
No. You know, Kool Herc ain't ever heard of me. Shit.
Yeah. So you hadn't heard of Kool Herc. And as far as New York influence as to what you guys were doing here in the late 70s, was there any direct New York influence? And if so, what was it?
Nah, man. Late 70s. We playing Chic. We playing Parliament Funkadelic. We didn't see a real, I think like 78 when Curtis Blow dropped Christmas Rapping, man. That was our first, that was one of my first introductions to East Coast rapping. And even that, because it was a Christmas song, it was considered a phenomenon. It was considered something that was seasonal, that wasn't gonna be around forever. You know, then shortly after that, here comes Rappers Delight, and that changed everything. That not only was that was a pivotal song, but it was a motivational song for everybody. In fact, Wrecking Crew, guys, you don't know, my first crew, and that's the part people, it drained them, is like my second crew. Mm-hmm. We went in the studio and did the same, did a similar type of song to Rock Skate Roll Bounce.
Oh yeah, skate.
Yeah, we called it EAD Rap. We never released it. We recorded it, but we never released it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at that time, my record knowledge was very minimum. And because of the word federal on the bottom of records, and I'd been warned, you're gonna get sued. And I'm thinking sued would get you back then, would get you thrown in jail, okay? So I'm 22, I don't know nothing about the law. So I never released the record. I still got the recording. In fact, I'm gonna take it to my guy and let them bake it and see if they can transfer it to a thumb drive. Cause that's the first West Coast record. It never came out, but that was one of the first West Coast records that was recorded on back in the day.
Okay. So we in the late 70s, you know, we establishing hip hop on the West side, on the West Coast. And we're seeing that although so you're saying basically when Rappers Delight and those songs on the radio came out, that was your first time really touching whatever influence New York had once it hit the radio. Would that be fair?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, understand this. I belong to a record pool even in 78, 79, 79. I belong to a record pool. And that's when we started getting different records in. None of them really hit though. But like I said, Rappers Delight hit. Something else hit out of New York. Super Rhymes hit for us too. Mm-hmm. And but again, at Eve After Dark, we going between Knee Deep and Rappers Delight. Mm-hmm. Playing a lot. We even played KC and the Sunshine Band. you got to understand, dude. The music of that time, color lines in regards to what you would play or who you would play. Mm-hmm. Nobody really tripped on the fact Casey and the Sunshine Band was white. They give a damn. They were some bad boys.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't care that the Bee Gees was white. They had some shit.
Okay. Yes, they did.
If you was a DJ, you had to rock Saturday Night Fever. It must be the Night Fever. You had to play that shit.
Yeah.
And brothers, and this the era, man, this the whole disco era, and I got to say this because this was my era of beginning. The whole disco era has been totally overlooked by movie makers and everything. Because it was outside of Saturday Night Fever, I can't recall another movie from that era. But that was a very pivotal era, man. That was a very pivotal era. And it was so powerful, they had to make a concentrated effort to destroy it. Because disco had taken over radio. Had taken over everything, okay? Disco was like a fungus, a cancer that was eating up everything, and they couldn't, because they created it and it got away from them. I forgot this dude's name. He went to this baseball game and just blew up a bunch of
The Chicago White Sox game, 1979.
Right. Blew up a bunch of disco records and coined the phrase "disco sucks," and disco died. And go ahead.
It's crazy you say that disco died, because when you started off by where we are right now, disco, they killed disco on the surface level because of how powerful it was, but it recreated itself through house, EDM, and that kind of stuff.
It was still well loved, man. You see, disco died, and this is my third time having this conversation in the last past 10 days. Disco died for two reasons. One, the most influential reason, I think the most powerful reason, disco got connected to the gay lifestyle. Because a lot of your clubs back in New York were gay clubs that played a lot of disco. And disco, you know, that was one of them times when gay people could have a good time and be flamboyant the whole nine yards. And then the drug scene, okay? Cocaine and disco was hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine and disco was hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, not powder cocaine. I mean, not crack cocaine.
Yeah.
Powder cocaine. That was the champagne drug. That was the whole thing. That was the whole movement behind Studio 54.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you got one sub element that kind of really kicked it in the nuts. And that's when you got your, because you got to be able to dance a little bit to be doing disco. Disco ain't like rock and roll. You can just bop around. No. You got to come with some movement. And to see your white woman out there getting flung around by these black studs and these tight ass pants, and you on the sidelines trying to be cool doing this bullshit right here. Brothers gonna take it to the next level.
Yeah.
Then the white man like, hey man, disco sucks. Fuck this. Okay. We need rock and roll. Okay. And then they tried to say the same thing about hip hop, but hip hop and disco had two different origins. Mm-hmm. And that's what made hip hop survive and disco not survive. Disco was kind of manufactured. It was a music thing. Producers from all over the world would make this music. And sometimes they would hire musicians or singers to play in front of it. That Milli Vanilli shit, that shit had been going on in disco forever.
Yeah, yeah.
That was no new, that they just got caught.
Yeah.
They just got caught. But in disco, that was almost the standard. You'd hire a background singer who can sing and put a track on top of her. And a lot of the people you never saw. You never went to a disco concert.
Martha Wash and all them.
Yeah, they be blowing like a summer on all these damn disco songs. And, you know, you never saw them in concert.
Mm-hmm.
Then when hip hop came around, because when I started knocking on doors trying to get record deals, they told me in my face dozens of times, it's got about a 2-year lifespan. It's going to be dead. Just like disco. And the problem was, hip hop was never meant to be corporate. It was grassroots. Hip hop didn't care whether it went mainstream or not. It was something from the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a whole different foundation. So if they crushed it, all it was going to do was go back home to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
When you crush disco and all the money came out of disco because it was already inflated anyway, or it was already manufactured anyway, and people stopped putting money into it, because disco production was a lot different than hip hop production.
Mm-hmm.
Disco, you had charts and you had orchestras and you had, you know, real players making this shit happen. So you got a lot of folks making money, you know, making these disco records, and they would hire a bunch of studio musicians from the union, give them some charts, and they bump, you know, hit these chords and hit these strings and read these charts. You get paid and go home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the hip hop, because we started sampling before sampling was even had a name for it, we sampling shit. And because, and I did something else. People forget that before you had headphones stuck in your head, you had them big ass Radio Raheem boom boxes.
Yeah.
So you had a radio station everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. So that shit was already being pumped into the streets and it was already infectious, it was already locked in. So when they tried to kill it, you couldn't kill it. It was like a roach. Think I live here. I ain't going nowhere. I'm gonna be here when you go. I got real roots. You may get one or two artists, but the root of hip hop ain't gonna go nowhere because it was never supposed to be corporate anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything else, man. Whether it's fried chicken, party supplies, or buffalo wings. If people see us making money, they're going to jump on and try to take it over. And that's what happened.
That's real talk. So in the early days of hip hop, who do you remember as the first MC to grab a mic and rap over somebody with the DJ playing? Who do you remember first out here out West?
World Class Wrecking Crew. Yeah, we did that. We did it even after dark. Our song was called the EAD Rap. And we just, like I said, I went to the studio and recorded it. I didn't know how to make records. I just made the recording. I guess I had a buddy of mine make me a 15-minute version of Rock Skate Roll Bounce, and me and my boys rapped on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And after we went to the studio and recorded this shit, and but we never put it out.
Around what year was that?
Gotta be about 79.
Okay.
79, 80. 79, gotta be 79. Because we were way ahead. We was way ahead of the game. We came out right after shit. We did this right after Sugar Hill.
Okay, so yeah, so you basically heard that what that on the radio, and then you did your own version. So it wasn't like when I was watching the Hip Hop 50 celebration, they're making it seem as if everybody was going to New York and getting everything directly from New York, and from there it went everywhere else. So again, it was really just you guys doing your own version of what you're like all music. You hear something, you inspired, and you do your own way. You have your own way of doing it.
They just didn't know what I was doing. That's all. Yeah. I mean, we had a little small. We had a club in the community in right near Compton, and yeah. We were just doing shit, man, just to keep the club packed.
Tell us about Eve After Dark.
Eve After Dark, man, was a phenomenon in my life, dude. I never thought I'd own a club at 22 years old. My dad came out to Alpine Village. No. My dad caught me with some money, okay? He came by my house one day. His house, my house was his house, technically. My mom split up. My mom passed. I moved into her house. Uh-huh. I'm 19 years old. I moved into her house. I'm staying there. He come by and check on me from time to time. It's his pet. He got keys. So at one point, he came by the house right after Alpine Village. It was Saturday morning. And I'm sitting on the bed counting money. He like, nigga, where you got the money from? It looked like a lot of money. It was about $400, $500, you know?
Yeah.
Five, okay? So it looked like I just did some major shit. And my old man always had a disdain for drug dealers. And he thought, because everybody in my neighborhood sold drugs. Everybody did. But I never did. And all of them tell you, I never did. That was a hustle because I had a different hustle. But he thought I would start selling drugs. He told me I would beat your ass and turn you in myself, okay, if I catch you selling drugs. Nah, man, I ain't selling no drugs. I'm over at Alpine Village. And he knew where Alpine Village was. We passed by it every week going to cut lines in Torrance. So he came by my next event and saw that we had a great night kicking ass. He got excited. Hey, man, damn, you got something going on good here. And he got asked him about the numbers. I told him, you're paying this, paying how much for one night?
Mm-hmm.
In Alpine Village with my, like 2 months, might have been 3 months rent of his house, okay? My old man's rent house, his house note, $185, okay? Yeah. $185 a month, okay? And I'm paying $600-$700 for one night. Niggas, he just like, he don't understand it. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you see it?
I see it.
The Alpine Village, and back in the day, it had that fake snow on the top back in the day.
Yeah, now that right there is the new version. That's the side of it. But yeah, that's where we started that, dude. And my old man came by there and saw it, and his partner had just built a second story to his nightclub. It was a banquet hall.
Uh-huh.
He took me to the meeting. And I'm going up there with the intentions and thinking that I'm just going to, rent this club every 2 weeks like I'm doing Alpine Village. Mm-hmm. Two old dudes sitting up there, they just start drinking. I ain't drank nothing. They drinking and talking shit. And old man finally says, hey, I tell you what, if you want it, you got it. But the deal is I want $300 a night, Friday and Saturday. And you got to take it every weekend. Huh?
Oh.
But when the deal sounds crazy as shit at first, it sounds, oh my God, that's $2,400 a month. But should we doing that one night at Alpine? Mm. I got 8 nights to do that. I got 8 nights. And you see, when the deal first came to me, it was like, God damn, that's a lot of money. $2,400 a month? And he said, give it to me every week. He didn't put that kind of pressure on me. Give it to me every week when you got it, okay? Give it this time to me on Monday. You ain't got to pay it up front. So I can go out here, hang my posters, pass out my flyers, do two parties, and bring you $600 on Monday morning. That was the deal. And with no money, no first and last, no credit checks, no paperwork, no contract. No con. I ain't got a contract. I left to Eva to Dark in 2019. I didn't stay there the whole time, but I was in and out of there for 40 years. I never had a contract. We never signed a contract. We just had the old man and I had a great understanding. My old man told me when I first walked up them steps, walked in that man's office, he said, I can get you in, I can't keep you in. And me and the old man hit it off. Now him and my daddy is partners. Mm-hmm. Him and my daddy is partners. They drinking buddies.
Yeah.
But he looked out for me. He gave me a ton of game, man. Dude, my last job was 3 weeks before I met him. And I ain't never worked again, dude. I never had a job again. I've had contracts. I ain't never punched another clock again because that old man taught me how to hustle, how to stay job free. Because he did it. Real estate and nightclubs, and he gave me his nightclub to run. And like I said, until he died in 2019, I ran that joint, man. Yeah. I gave my keys to him. He gave them back, said, you might want to come back. Keep them.
Wow.
That's the kind of relationship we had, man. So, but when I first heard the deal, and I'm in my head, 3 times 4 is 24. Divided by 8, that's 300. Well, shit, I got a capacity of 300. We putting 4-5 in Alpine every other Friday. Even if I miss, I got a second day to get it back. Let's do it, okay? It made sense. And it started off slow because you're trying to get kids from Carson, Torrance, and other areas to come to East Hood.
El Segundo and Avalon.
Avalon, El Segundo, baby.
Yeah.
It was a sales pitch, but again, because my at Alpine Village, I got a big old sign say Disco Lonzo. I've always been a marketing son of a bitch. So I got my backdrop behind me right now.
Yeah.
I've always been a marketing son of a bitch. Yeah. Disco Lonzo is the DJ at Eve After Dark. Oh, that's the brother from Alpine. Mm-hmm. And dude, eventually after a little while, we never had a terrible weekend where we had to come out of the pocket for all the money. We would be short sometime. Okay? We made enough money where it was worth the while to keep going. And we made enough money for the first couple of months. Even when we were short, my backer, she'd kick in, make up the difference. We go buy some more posters, buy some more flyers, buy some more posters, pay the rent, buy some more posters, buy some more flyers. Sometimes we make all the rent and had to go get money for posters and flyers. Sometimes we made enough money just to survive for the next week, pay the rent, and buy most posters and flyers. Mm-hmm. And one day we hit with Cameo, man.
It's crazy you say that because the last time I saw Cameo live was about 10 years ago at Alpine Village. It's like, it was like doing like 2012, 13. Like they were back at...
They were bringing shows. My buddy was doing... He was bringing shows to Alpine Village. Some dinner shows.
Yeah, I was at that one. The last time Cameo was there.
Yeah. So we hit it. We brought Cameo to Eve After Dark, man. And shit, we didn't look back for the next 18 months.
Yeah, man.
It was another musical phenomenon.
Yes, it was, man. And so I tell people all the time, you know, because it, music takes on its environment. In L.A., we couldn't necessarily throw park jams because LAPD had a boots in your ass with the parks out here. So you guys had to have the environment out here call for more clubs, backyards, and things like that. What do you have to say about that?
You know, man, I was talking about this just yesterday. You know, the attitude of some black people have cost us all a lot of shit when it comes to entertainment. That's why you don't have theaters in the black community. Man, you can't put niggas in the dark. Somebody gonna do some stupid shit. You can't put niggas on skates in the hood because niggas gonna kick him, you know, go. And people forget, man. People forget. Every time any business, anybody that's in business, they have this hidden responsibility and this hidden partner called the insurance company. And when you shoot somebody, stab somebody, I don't give a damn whether it's the owner ain't got to have nothing to do with it. They still gonna sue his ass. Which means they gonna sue the insurance company. and the insurance company got to hire investigators and fight the case and probably pay, you know, pay a settlement, or somebody want to pull some bullshit because they broke and they want to sue the skating rink or the club. And after a while, you increase the cost of doing business so much, it's not worth the hassle. Mm-hmm. And that's why you don't have shit in the hood. Some people cannot control their emotions long enough to, hey man, let's take this around the corner. So when something happens in a venue like a nightclub or restaurant, the restaurant's being held responsible, which is the dumbest shit in the world. Why am I responsible for another grown man's actions is beyond me, but they take, the slick ass lawyers come up with some kind of way to put the owner who's in the office responsible for two people that's fighting that met and had a big beef at school or at the job. They just happened to meet at his facility, but yet and still he's responsible, mm-hmm. which is the dumbest shit in the world.
It is.
And that's why you don't have a lot of stuff in the community, okay?
Yeah.
You niggas better hope they don't start fighting laundry mats. We're going to be the dirtiest people in the fucking world. Niggas start fighting laundry mats, we're going to be some dusty, dirty son of a bitches, okay?
Yeah, man. Oh, man. This is Alonzo Williams, founder of the West Coast hip hop, the scene, and what we have going on here, along with Roger Clayton and others. Talk to us about your partnership with Roger Clayton, how you, Uncle Jam's Army, I don't know if you guys started together, how you split up. How did that happen, that time with you and what Uncle Jam had going on in those early days in the act that you guys were flying out, or you were flying out from the East Coast and other places? Talk to us about that time.
Well, just like I said, we're going to go in Alpine Village. Roger and I worked together at this record distributor, and he started his production company. It was Uncle Jam's original name was Unique Dreams Entertainment. Okay, Unique Dreams Entertainment, and I was Disco Lonzo, Disco Construction. And we started, like I said, we started Alpine, and Roger and I had a chance to leave Alpine and go start Eve After Dark. I started Eve After Dark under Disco Construction. And Roger, I asked him to be my partner. He said, nah, man, too many sherm heads, too many crackheads. Well, too many sherm heads, well, no crackheads then. Too many sherm heads, you got that, man, you got that. So as we struggled, Roger would come by there, kind of gloat a little bit. Oh, man, I told you. And we finally hit. Mm-hmm. He came by, man, you still need a partner? Hell no, nigga, what I need you for now? Shit, I can't put another body in this joint. I mean, literally, we could, with the capacity of Eve, is legally 299, and we already at 500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We already at 500. I can't put another human being in this motherfucker. So what I need you for? Just cut into my profit, and it pissed him off. You have to understand, Roger. He was a megalomaniac. He wanted to be in have his hand in every damn thing. And I am nigga, nah, kiss my ass. And that sparked, man, I'm gonna be the biggest promoter in the world. You watch. And then shortly after that, he changed his name to Uncle Jam's Army, which is after some George Clinton shit, mm-hmm. and started doing dances. And he eventually became successful. Mm-hmm. And their biggest claim to fame was doing the sports arena. Mm-hmm. And they did three dances at the sports arena. And because they were heavily patronized by the Rolling 60s Crips back in the day, Rolling 60s Crips followed Uncle Jam's Army wherever they went. Mm-hmm. And hate a havoc incurred in that following. Mm-hmm. And so I never really messed with it because I come from the east side of town. Mm-hmm. We heavy into the red team.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's why I stayed on the east side. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right near Compton. Eve is not in Compton, it's right near Compton. So I was able to do Eve. I had three venues in that area, Eve, Skateland, and Dudo's. Mm-hmm. And I never had a problem because y'all ain't coming over here. mm-hmm. And eventually, when I was doing Skateland, I mean, I was doing Dudo's on Fridays, Skateland on Saturdays, and the record crew started having success in the record industry. So we started traveling, started touring, and Roger tried to slide into Skateland, and he did for a few events. And it was okay for a while till the Rolling 60s came over there one time too many, and them Crips and Bloods, no, I mean, I'm doing this. Y'all ain't doing it like this. Mm-hmm. And everything got kind of messed up from that point on. But That's how we started off. We started off with being friends, and we had a love-hate relationship. Mm-hmm. Again, we were cool most of the time, but we were rivalries. Mm-hmm. And the shit that we did to each other to forge this West Coast hip-hop thing is stories of folklore. Okay? Our folklore. But, you know, but again, man, we never fought. Although I left my house a couple of times intending to whoop his ass because he do some low down shit. And I never put hands on him. And it just, we was always competing, man, because not only do we compete for clientele for our various events, we competed in record sales because he had his label, Uncle Jam's Army, or UJA, whatever it was. I had Crew Cut Records. The DJs competed. I had DJ Yella at first. He had Egyptian Lover. Then Dre came join my team. And I always wanted to put Dre or Yella against Egypt because I know they would melt his ass on the turntables. Mm-hmm. It never would take my challenge. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of envy because I had a stable club. I was the only guy from all the promoters that had his own venue every week. Mm-hmm. I was the envy of all promoters. So even if they did other dances, I'd do the after party.
Right.
Yeah, y'all go ahead. If they kick y'all out the hotel at 12 o'clock, I'm open till 4. Come on by. Bring your ticket stuff. I'll let you give you a discount. Oh, they hated my ass for that shit, but fuck them.
We talking about some real business going on. We talking this early 80s right now. We talking, right?
Yeah.
And
80 to about 84. I wasn't hated, but I was like, this motherfucker right here.
Yeah.
I know how to win. Okay, I know how to win, dude. You know, give me the perimeters, okay? And then y'all, yeah, go to the sports arena, go to the Queen Mary. And then I started doing my own outside parties and give my own after parties. That's what I really got hated on. I could have deal with the Queen Mary in Long Beach. I had the Queen Salon in Long Beach at the Queen Mary, packed it out for one holiday. And they said, we can't give you that room. We got to give you the tip of the boat, which is even more beautiful, man. Because we on the tip of the Queen Mary, outside on a wooden deck. And the DJ is pumping. You got the Long Beach skyline in the background. And I'm charging $10 for the first time. I had 1,100 niggas show up, dude. Oh, my God.
Uh-huh.
I had 1,100 black folks show up. And they had a good time. And I left there, stashed my money, and went to the Eve After Dark and charged them again. So, yes, I became envied. Okay. Yeah. I became envied, and I got the hottest crew in the city too. Come on, man!
And you, and so he has Egypt. You got Dre and Yella. Were they the ones DJing your parties, Dre and Yella?
Yeah, yeah. At some point, I became an executive DJ. I DJed at the E from time to time, but after a while, I was shit counting money and regulating security guards and. So we go outside doing an event. I got to man the floor. So they would do the DJing. I'd MC it all. I'd host all the shows. But then they would end up being the main DJs. And it just made for a different experience. Plus, I had to float around. Because at any given moment, one of the catering directors may need something. A security issue may jump off. Somebody may be at the front door. So I couldn't be tied to the turntable that long.
You was bossing.
I'm the boss. I got elevated to boss status.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And then I had to be able to leave a little bit early so I can go make sure the Eve is ready to go. So yeah, it was just a whole different thing, man. And I mean, dude, it was a great time back then, dude. It was a great fucking time for me.
You mentioned that Dre and them, they were the second class of the Wrecking Crew. So mm-hmm. how do you get that come across Dre and Yella? And And so you said when you came across them, they sort of came into something that was already built. Would that be correct?
They all came to me as patrons, put it that way.
Okay.
They were patrons of Eve After Dark before they came to work for me.
Okay, so they were coming to the parties at first before even the work.
It was paying like everybody else.
Okay.
I was already doing my thing. I had a couple of crews before them, and life started lifing and people started moving on. And then they came in, and by that time they came in, I started thinking about bringing in acts and more stuff. Because my first group was there, we were just having a good time. We didn't have nothing. It was just making money, dude, having a good time. And then, like anything else, just started slowing down. So I had to come up with different ways to get shit to jump off. And I started bringing in acts. And that's why I started bringing in a different clientele also. And that developed into Dre and Yella showing up one day. And when Run DMC played for me, they broke my microphone and played for Uncle Jam's Army the next night. I'm like, fuck them. Mm-hmm. I started my own goddamn group.
I heard you say that on Dr. Green Thumb show. That was very interesting right there. So you were flying Run DMC and those guys out. We're talking early 80s, right? So you're bringing these Curtis Blow and you're the one bringing these guys out here.
Bringing all these guys out there.
And then Run DMC basically breaks your mic. And out of that necessity, out of that fucker in your system, you say, damn them, let me do my own thing. Is that how?
I'm 24 years old. I got money. I got a nightclub. I got an attitude. Okay, I'm sorry. Look, man. You know, people, I got to say this shit, man, because as I'm 67 years old right now, and I can laugh and joke about this shit. But some nights at the Eve, it was always, niggas got tested, you know? And I had to go out there and take the test one way or another, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they know gangsters. I think I did more gangster shit than the average nigga to talk about it. I just don't talk about it. That's not my calling card. Mm-hmm. But you can't survive on Avalon Del
Fondo. I was just about to say that.
You can't survive on Avalon Del Fondo unless you can put some work in some way, form, or fashion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I ain't paid no taxes. I ain't got checked. I ain't checking in. I ain't do all that shit. I survived on my own, but it was, you know, it was a different game back then, okay? And you know, a lot of times, we had to go out there and represent. Nah, nigga, y'all can't punk us, okay? And the brothers who stood behind me or stood with me at that time are not the ones that made the records.
Yeah, it's not the ones that made the records. It's the ones it's the unseen ones.
They watched us stand. A lot of times, they was watching us stand up. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
They on the second string. If y'all whoop our asses, y'all got to get to these niggas. Right. Oh, if we win, it's like playing baseball. We up so high, y'all can jump in and get a little time on the field. Okay. y'all ain't first string.
Yeah.
Y'all not first. Y'all ain't the kind I'm caught. Hey man, when something jump off, I had a few cats. Hey man, we got to go out. Come on, follow me outside. Let's go outside. What was that, man? Don't worry about it. All right, let's go. Mm-hmm. Okay, and nobody that ever made a record was on that squad.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm glad you both drew that very clear distinction. The gangsters and the musicians are two different classes of people.
Nigga, I don't need a DJ. It's about to go down, nigga. I do not need a DJ to put the soundtrack to this ass whooping. We about to either give or receive. Okay.
yeah. I'm glad you said that. So how does it the NWA crew get together? How does that happen? Can you talk? Can you walk us through that? How that all from Wrecking Crew, second class of Wrecking Crew to NWA? How does that happen?
We made our first album, World Class. We got a record deal with Sony. And I'm already, as they say, nigga rich. And I had two choices. I was going to either buy Dudo's or buy this house I live in right now. Old man wanted to sell me Dudo's. I could have bought it for $200,000. Big lot, everything. Talking about the early 80s now, right?
Yeah.
Old man was cool. He liked me. He said, $200,000, you can have the whole damn thing. And we just got $100,000 from CBS. I'm sitting on some money myself. But I didn't understand financing. And again, I might be 25, 26 by now. I don't understand finances. So I'm thinking I got to give up all my money and go buy Dudo's. Plus, even if I do those, it took a bigger chunk of money. I had to put down 20%, which had been $40,000. Mm-hmm. And even though we got $100,000 CBS, it wasn't all mine. So I couldn't spend any money on something I was going to own. And I chose to buy a house that was owned by a former blues singer, a guy by the name of Johnny Otis.
Oh, I know about Johnny Otis, yeah.
Johnny Otis, you know, had a bunch of hits in the 50s and 60s. And he got rich. He got he hit a lick in the 80s with Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. He had a bunch of music in that thing. Plus, he got a bunch of advances. Well, he had just built this studio about 4 or 5 years before that. And the dude moved on. He moved to Altadena. Mm-hmm. And the house will make it. And my friend who lived around the corner from him, Etta James, called me and told me, hey, Eric, she called me Eric from the middle of the day. Eric, Johnny Otis just sold, just moved out of this house. You need to go buy it. Huh? You need to buy Johnny Otis. He got a studio and everything. You need to go buy his house. And I'm like, Etta, you need to buy Johnny Otis' house. And sure enough, I made a phone call to my real estate buddy, and we cut a deal. And I bought the house. So now,
you're 25. You know Etta James.
Yeah, Etta James. My dad cut her lawn. That's one of my dad's clients on the lawn service.
That's amazing by itself.
Yeah. If you ever seen the movies, and if you ever seen the movie Cadillac Records, it's a scene with her. She's at her home crying. Cause she just found out homeboy died, okay? And what's his name? Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Brand her a envelope with a deed to a house. Mm-hmm. Well, that house is around the corner from where I live at.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, yeah. All that shit was true. He was in love with her. He couldn't give her nothing, you know, physically at that time, but he paid her house off. Mm-hmm. Okay? And gave her the deed when he died.
Oh wow.
So, and the house is on the corner right where I lived at. Her son just, they just sold it, I don't know, about a couple of years ago now. But she was a good friend of the family, and she kept me, she gave me a lot of game on the record industry because she was a friend of the family. She told me not to watch out for this person. She told me, she warned me against dealing with Jerry Heller and Maury Alexander, his partner. She said, hey, watch him. Mm-hmm. It was like that. And, so yeah, she was one of my advisors for a long time, man.
That's amazing to see how the game get passed down like that.
All my advisors, anybody that I consider a music mentor, came from the blues era.
Yeah, the blues are the ones that, especially those that came out of that Chicago blues area. Those are the ones that got hit. Those are the black folks that got hit with the industry first.
Yeah, they beat the shit out of them with the industry.
Man.
It put them on drugs. They wouldn't pay them no money. They would give them Cadillacs. They wouldn't give them no money. You know, all kind of shit. And she, you know, and a lot of these guys didn't get record deals right away, or they did get record deals and got dropped. So they had to go form their own labels. Like my partner Swamp Dog, my first manager. Mm-hmm. He had a record deal for a while, then he got dropped. But you know how to make records. Mm-hmm. It's like if you know how to, if you go to school, if you work at a job doing a certain thing. You know how to do this shit. You just got to find a way to do it. And records, it don't take a whole lot. You can get some buddies to go make a record if you got the money for the studio time.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's why I learned a lot of my recording skills. Hey man, you don't go to the studio rehearsing. You rehearse that shit perfect at your house, in your garage, whatever the case may be. Then you go to the studio and drop that shit. Because back in the day, you didn't have an unlimited track. I think you had 8 tracks.
Mm-hmm.
What, nigga, everybody playing at the same time.
Yep.
The vocals, the drummer, the bass player, everybody singing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it wasn't until later on you got 16 and then 24 tracks, and now you got digital, unlimited digital tracks.
Yeah.
It was a whole different mindset.
Back then it was tape.
And
that was the era you go, going back to Dre and NWA. Let's talk to us about how that happened.
Well, now, because I got the studio at my pad, everybody's coming to my house. Everybody. Coolio over here. Lil Warren G. Easy just hanging out. Rand is over here. Yella over here. D. Barnes from Pump It Up. Her partner Rose. DJ Pooh. A young Ice Cube. Jinx. KD. Everybody. Everybody's coming through here, man. Young DJ Quick. Compton. I mean, and these guys... My house became like the Mecca. It was the Motown house of that hip hop era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm Barry Gordy, and I'm slinging records most of the time. I got a roommate. Rose is my roommate. She's kind of running the house when I'm not here because I'm running the streets selling records all day. Meanwhile, Dre in the studio making beats all day.
Mm.
Okay. And I was kind of our format. So, because I was an independent record label, but because my last job, I sold records over the phone to record stores. So I knew all these people. I didn't have no UPS. I couldn't afford UPS. So I would drop. I had a van. I'd go pick up my records from the record plant and take them all to the different record stores and go get my money.
Mm-hmm.
Me in the studio, learn how to make beats. Mm-hmm. They wasn't good yet. They was all right. So my first record was some underground mixes called Xerox.
Mm-hmm.
I was slanging the shit out of them damn things. We'd make them things all day long, and that was one of our hustles. We make so many Xerox in a month, and sometimes I'd make so much money on Friday, between Thursday and Friday, dropping them off at the record store. I didn't want to go to the club, and the club was making good money. I want to do something. I don't want to be at the club. I made $4,000 or $5,000 on by Friday. I got some more. I didn't stay at the club. It was almost a hassle to be at the club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, we had a peak time in hip hop history. That's what I'm saying. People don't know all the shit I have done to pave the way.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know I own Z-Rock, Cut Up, Mixed Track, Mixed Tricks, House Party. I had about 4 or 5 underground labels because records was coming out so fast. I created my own competition with myself so that nobody else would compete with me.
Mm. See, and you used, you had access to things like One Stops and K-Day. How did that all work together? Having a radio station like K-Day, having these One Stop labels that were all up and down here through LA. How did that all work together?
K-Day, I became a K-Day customer for EU After Dark. And my salesperson, Rochelle Lucas, never forget her, still my friend to this day. She told me about this new program director, this new DJ that was gonna soon be the program director named Greg Mack. That was coming to town, and I should meet him. Okay, cool, whatever. So me and Greg had a meeting. I just shut the Eve down. Eve had just shut down. Oh man, Eve got too big for Avalon El Segundo. The Eve had got too big.
Yeah.
You couldn't do shit. You couldn't park around the club. You couldn't send no gas. You couldn't do shit. And the Eve was open. And the old man made me shut it down. And I just cut a deal with old man Dudos, Dootsy, to come to Dudos on Friday nights. All I want now is Friday nights. I didn't want Friday and Saturday. I'll take Fridays. But it was a much bigger venue. And when I met with Greg, I was showed him some of my Xerox that I had. He thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I want y'all to do a mix for me every day, 5 days a week, 15-minute mix, and we're going to play it on K-Day. We're going to call it a traffic jam. Now, I'm used to making records, but Greg, all he wanted was to do the mix and give it to him on tape. Cool! But in exchange for that, I need you to give us a plug before and after the traffic jam starts so we can promote our spot Dudos, okay? And at 5 o'clock, the most anticipated recorded time of the day and the busiest traffic day time because everybody's on the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody trying to get home.
Everybody
got that radio on. Traffic Jam brought to you by the World Class Record Crew live every Friday at Dudos, 135th Central. Don't forget, this Traffic Jam is brought to you by the World Class Record Crew. You can see them every Friday live at Dudos Music Center on the corner of 135th and Central. That was all the advertising I ever used for Dudos. And those traffic jams blew up, and then they blew up Dudos.
You bring back memories, man, because like my dad played the old school stuff, but my Uncle Jesse, he was always the hip-hop. My dad's younger brother, and I remember being in the car with him, listening to those traffic jams. And then even like, I mean, he used to go to Dudos. He used to go to these parties. And I remember hearing about Ice Cube gave Dudos a shout out as far as his roots on the song Growing Up that he did on his Laugh Now Cry Later album. He talked about him and KD rapping that his first time rapping was at Dudos with KD on that song in front of a crowd, one of his early times. I know I don't want to have you here all day because I know you got things to do, but my personal favorite artist in hip hop all time is Ice Cube. Talk to me a little bit about Cube and him coming around. This is. Listeners, this is for me. But go ahead, brother.
And Cube, I met Cube. They was doing a Best of the West contest. KD was doing the Best of the West contest at World on Wheels. And Cube had been coming around the house, but I didn't pay. He was 15 years old. I ain't Michael Jackson. So I ain't paying no 50-year-old kids no attention. He was just another one of the kids at the pad. I'm keeping it 100.
Yeah.
I'm the grown man, dude. They all there with Dre. I knew Jinx. It was Dre's cousin. And KD was always super cool. And, you know, as long as they was cool, I didn't trip. And we got our deal at CBS. Larkin Arnold, who was our executive producer, asked me, did I have any more acts? And I'm like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I ain't have shit. Okay? But I knew these guys had just lost the Best in the West contest, but they were pretty good. So I had Dre put together a demo for Ice Cube and them. It was called She's a Skag, and they changed, and they was called the Stereo Crew at that time. Okay? And I took it to Larkin Arnold. He loved it. It was an answer record to Fly Girls.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And he loved it, gave him a single deal. All right? And they were 16, because I had to go to court the whole night. I had lawyers. I had to pay for their lawyers. I had to go to court. I had to get a judge to approve the contract. Oh, it was a motherfucking hassle. Mm-hmm. Okay? And their record came out before ours did. And if you look at the I think it's the Billie Jean video. Billie Jean, a Thriller video. One of them motherfuckers. Michael's coming into the house, and this woman is left a note and a sandwich in the refrigerator. You'll hear it faintly in the background. Mm. Anyway, you ain't gonna see.
That's Billie Jean, man.
Billie Jean, okay. You hear it faintly in the background, and my new documentary, NWA, we show how this happens. And so Cube them got a record deal at 16 years old. And then our shit came out. We got our deal with Sony. And we all got dropped. And we all got dropped right after that. And we went back to Makola with our tail between our legs. And I cut three singles with them. This time they changed their name from Stereo Crew to Crew in Action. Okay? And they had a three single EP. And we had a little issue because they wanted to call themselves Criminals in Action.
Mm-hmm.
And me being the big dog and being the responsible big dog, y'all can't be criminals on my label. You see, all this shit is brand new. All this gang banging and criminal shit. This shit was not accepted yet, man.
Yeah.
You can't do that. You 14, 15, 16 years old. Your mama put you in trust me to let you record. I'm gonna let you call yourself a criminal, knowing goddamn well you ain't a criminal. Can't do that, okay? And y'all can be Crew in Action, but you can't be Criminals in Action. So they changed it to Crew in Action, and it sounded like three Beastie Boy knockoff records.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I didn't care. I wasn't tripping. I didn't care. It was all good records. Illegal for the Cash or something else, man. And again, because it came through Makola, and Makola was going through its bullshit at the time, it didn't do no numbers. And Makola, we dropped the House Calls EP, and didn't do no numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We found out Makola was trying to cross-collateralize our old shit with our new shit. Anyway, make a long story short, everybody got mad at Lonzo, okay? Because we didn't get paid like from Makola like we should have for the few numbers that we did do. And shortly after that, they started NWA.
Mm-hmm.
That brought the collaboration between the Dre and the Cube at that time.
Okay.
He was going to Washington for a while. Then he started going to Taft out in the Valley. And he still found a way over here in the afternoons to hang out with Dre. And he was not a, they were never bad kids. They were never a pain in the ass. Jinx could be annoying as fuck, cause nigga always dancing and playing and shit. Annoying. And for me, it was cool because they were all three Geminis.
Okay.
They was all, and we, me, Cube, Jinx, KD, all Geminis.
I'm a Gemini too, so I know.
And your birthday.
June 17th?
I'm June 16th.
Oh, yeah, you right there. Yeah.
So, you know, and when I people don't talk about astrology, but they do. But when you look at some of the baddest, okay, that made records to do entertainment, you know, look at you're looking at a goddamn Gemini.
Oh, I get into that here. You got Kanye, you got Prince, you got Tupac, you got Cube.
Yeah.
You can go down the line because the Gemini, we can see multiple sides of things. And so we write.
Right. You see, and that's what made Tupac for me, Biggie. That's what made Tupac for me one of my favorite artists, because Tupac was the only gangster rapper ever gave a fuck about women on his records.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only gangster rapper that ever showed females any love. Nobody else is gonna give a fuck about him. And as much as I love Cube, I ain't never heard Cube make a, you know, he talked about Kim doing it all night, but I ain't never gave nobody no dear mama or nothing like that.
Yeah.
You know, and he showed that softer side of him, and that's why women liked him the way he did. What they do.
Yeah, that's what it is, Gemini. Man, you giving us a lot. You know, whenever, you know, me personally, I would love to do more of these interviews with you when you have time and link up, because this is something that has to be documented, has to be put out there. And, you know, you're such a crucial part. And I know you got your channel. So in the description bar, we have the link to Lonzo's channel in the description. So cause I want you guys to please subscribe to his channel and look at what he does, because this is a very crucial, pivotal role. And you get to see the family continuity, how hip hop really got cultivated the same way a lot of our music got cultivated. Some of the OGs seeing some of the young cats coming up, creating an environment, teaching them the game, and then going on. I got one last question. When it comes to that part between you, them with you, and then going with NWA, now we insert Jerry Heller. How did you get separated from the group? Was it when that Jerry Heller move happened? How did that happen?
Jerry Heller had been jockeying to be my manager forever. Mm-hmm. And I would, he already managed the LA Dream Team. He already managed Egyptian Lover.
Mm-hmm.
And his partner had managed LA Dream Team. And Etta James had warned me about his partner. Okay. And so I wasn't messing with Jerry, because, and Etta James in her own way, she said some shit. She said some more crazy shit like, dogs in the same pen got the same fleas. What the fuck that? Dogs in the same yard got the same fleas, which means if motherfuckers run together, they probably the same way. So I was real reductive. Plus, I had already had a manager, Swamp Dog. And when we went to CBS, to Sony, I'm sorry, went to Sony, Swamp Dog didn't want us to do a major. He didn't want us to do a major deal. He did, nah, man, stay independent. We making money, blah, blah, blah. But I'm already got money. I'm straight. I'm on my second house. Everybody else living with their mama, you know, and ain't got no cars, and driving buckets or whatever the case may be. So I couldn't be selfish, which I should have been, but I couldn't be selfish. So when the 100,000 came down, we took it. So Swamp Dog resigned as our manager. I took over the reins as the manager for a while, and we just got the deal with CBS, and they came looking for us. I didn't give them no demo. They came looking for us based on our world-class album and our success in the streets. And so when they offered us the deal, here's the crazy part. I got to share this for you. They went to Mercola and they had a meeting for, they got a Wrecking Crew, Bobby Jimmy and the Critters, LA Dream Team, and Egyptian Lover. We all in the lobby at the same time, and the Sony office, and we all had appointments a half hour apart. Okay, we got the record deal. Wrecking Crew got the deal, and so my lawyer, I had just hired a lawyer, Kent Clavins, and I says, "Hey man, do I need a manager?" He said, "For what?" I said, "Well, shit, man, we got a deal." And I said, "Well, all they gonna do, they're gonna send me a contract. I'm gonna review it. I'm going to take out what I don't like. I'm going to relay it to your manager. He's going to relay it to you. You're going to tell him what you want. He's going to tell me. Cut out the middleman and you save yourself $20,000. Cool. So I cut the deal with my lawyer. and saved us $20,000. Jerry didn't like that. He didn't like that. This nigga too smart. This nigga, he ain't one of the blues singers.
Okay? Yeah, right.
He ain't one of the blues singers, okay? So, he's still around. He's still around. But we ain't broke bread yet. So when I got our check back, I did an analysis of the funds, and come to find out we was about 6,000 short on our when they gave us our check. I couldn't figure out where it was. I didn't know enough about the game. So instead of me calling Ken Clavins, Jerry Heller, I ran into him some way, form, or fashion. He said, I'll look into it and see what I can do. So Jerry found the $6,000. It was at the union. They took out some money. We weren't union. We weren't on SAG-AFTRA yet, but they took out money anyway. And we had to go, what they call Taft-Hartley, to get our money, because we wouldn't join the union. We weren't sure if we were going to be there long enough to be a part of the union. Make a long story short, Jerry came back with we got four checks for $1,500 a piece. At that time, $1,500 was like $150,000.
Yeah.
Niggas was excited.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Jerry Heller could walk on water and feed the masses with a few fish. Okay. And Dre and Yella talked about Jerry Heller so much till it made easy want a meeting. Mm-hmm. Okay. And by this time, because I asked him and said, you know, he wants to be our manager. What y'all want to do? Cool. Let's sign with him. So we signed with him. Okay. So now, yeah, that's what it was. He signed. We signed with him after he got us our money. So now, easy thing, dissipate. You know, I want to meet him. And Jerry's like, nah, I don't want to meet nobody else. I got my hands full. I got Egyptian Lover. I got you guys. I'm good. And Easy had ran up a studio bill in my studio when he went to jail, fucking with Dre. When Dre went to jail. And so now, Easy playing with my money. And because he's playing with my money, I'm getting a little frustrated, because Easy kept money in his sock and in his pockets. The pocket was the flea money. The sock was the real money. The nigga looked like he was on house arrest, kept so much money in his goddamn socks. Okay, big ass knot on the sock. Nigga, fuck your pockets, go to your socks. Give me some sock money. And every once in a while, he'd break me off, but still, he'd run up a bill. Anyway, make a long story short, which is almost too late. He wanted to meet with Jerry, and I'll pay you money, I'll you for the studio. No, man, you can't give me what you owe me and want me to do you a favor. So he offered me another $250 to hook him up with Jerry. And according to Jerry, he paid Alonzo $1,000 to meet me. Nah, not quite. He already owed me $200. He owed me $500, and he gave me another $250. So it was deal with $750. And like I said before, it was already something already was there before you even got to you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I made after a good little time of convincing Jerry to meet with Easy, he did. I'll do it for you. I'll do it for you. Okay, cool. Appreciate it. They met. And like I tell everybody, man, I didn't think much of the other connection. And even after that, Jerry, man, I don't know, man. There's cussing on the record, and these guys are from Compton. And how does a Jewish guy from the Valley represent a group from Compton called Niggas with Attitude? Very carefully, very carefully. And, but again, according to his story, and I met Easy with like meeting John Lennon. No, man, bullshit. I'm here to tell a story. So, this shit, you know, he shopped him around, couldn't get nothing going. And he went to my boy, he went to another one of his guys, Brian Turner, over at Priority Records, who just had, all he had was the Raisins and the Egyptian Lover. Jerry got him a deal. I think Jerry got an Egyptian Lover a deal at Priority. And so he took him Eazy-E, and they reluctantly put out the old album that Eazy had before. And the shit started working. And but people forget, man. In the beginning, he was always, I work for Ruthless. Because in the beginning, that shit was not accepted, man. It was not. That shit was not flying. That bitches and hoes shit was not flying. In fact, we had a meeting. All the people that Jerry represented,
LA Dream Team, Egyptian Lover, World Class Wrecking Crew. We all had a meeting with Jerry Heller at this restaurant up in Hollywood. And we gave him an ultimatum. Hey, man, it's going to be us and him. He chose them. Cool. You know, that's what it was.
That's what it was. Okay. I see. Wow, that's a very, very interesting. I never heard that story. And I want to thank you for letting us know that. Because here at this channel, we track the history of Black American music and how it branched out and everything. You just gave us information that I couldn't get through research. So I appreciate you.
You won't know.
Yeah. Is there anything last things you want to close out, leave the people with before we get up out of here?
Check out my current my documentary Eve After Dark. It's on Tubi, Amazon, and on YouTube. And my new documentary, which is named after my sign behind me, NWA, Not Without Alonzo, is wrapping up its film festival run right now. We'll be coming out. It should be on the streaming services shortly. We're looking to do our distribution deal. And that right there, the two of these together, people will get a good understanding of what the fuck happened. You still won't know it all, okay? You still won't know it all. People, man, Lonzo, man, you do too many interviews. You're going to tell your whole story. Nigga, I got 50 years of this shit.
Yeah.
It's stories, and people been with me, Dusty and I have been doing our show for about 7 years. And you're still like, man, I didn't ever heard it before. You never asked me.
Yeah.
So I do this so I can, sometimes it's good for me, so I can recall some shit that I forgot.
Yeah.
I've forgotten more shit than most people have lived. So, yeah. And that my Tony story, I haven't told that in God knows how long, but it's in my book, but I hadn't told it because most people don't know how to know to ask. So
Yeah. I love that channel that you have over here on YouTube. I've been a subscriber now for about 5 years.
And much love.
So it's a lot of gold that you have over there. You know, you had a great interview with Dr. Green Thumb. Salute to Be Real, you know, for allowing you to put it out there. And go ahead.
Shout out to Mellow Man Ace, though. Mellow Man Ace, that's my dude from way back, man. Mellow Man Ace, Kid Frost, the Latin Connection, man. We go back, man, seriously. And when I told Mellow Man I need to talk to Dr. Green Thumb, he made it happen, man. So much shout out to him, too.
Salute. And yeah, I just want to let you know, man, you appreciate it, Alonzo. And this younger generation coming up, we want to know everything we can from you. And you know, we sometimes in our history, sometimes, you know, the Black folks, one generation don't want to pass it down and the younger generation don't want to listen. We breaking that. We want to make sure, you know, as long as you hear to pass it down, we want to listen.
You know something, I tell any youngster, listening to another youngster, nigga, that's blind leading the blind. If you ain't talking to some, I'm going to give you some examples. You ain't never seen an NBA coach the same age as the players. All the coaches, all the basketball coaches, football coaches, they always are older than the players. Why? They got experience. You ain't seen teachers may not be much older than the students, but they're older than the students because they got the education to teach you what you need to know. And what's really beautiful, man, me and my partner was laughing about this just the other day. Man said, dude, do you realize how many cats didn't get as far as we did? Mm-hmm. And on the West Coast, yeah, there's a couple of people. One person older than me, Disco Daddy, but his resume ain't nowhere near as thick as mine. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And to share this shit at 68, I'll be 68 on my next birthday. To share this shit at 68 years old. Dude, I never thought when I was 22 that I'd be sharing these stories at 68. It was no way I would ever, man. And people don't realize because youngsters don't look forward to getting older. Oh, this is one of the best times of my life, dude.
Yeah.
When you start hitting that 50, 55, and I didn't even realize being so-called a senior citizen could be so much damn fun. But you got to prepare for it. Let me say this before I go. You got to prepare for it. In more ways than one. You can't fuck all your money off, man, now and expect you to be doing okay when you get to be a senior citizen. Shit's changing every damn day. And you got to take care of yourself health-wise too, Doc. Go, nigga, take a walk, pick up something heavy from time to time. and just you can't smoke all the weed, you can't drink all the drink, okay? And just understand, man, you can do whatever you want to in moderation. But youngsters, they don't, a lot of youngsters don't feel they having a good time unless they're on the brink of death. Nigga, please, okay? You can't get that damn high. If you get to a certain point, you get that damn high, you start losing shit, man. I was laughing. We're about to open the Eve back up. I had to say, I'm finna sound like an asshole, but I said, damn. Because I opened the Eve, and I had the Eve. I always had somebody of substance abuse that was worked for, you know, for a good, you know, reasonable amount of money. I had a wino, crackheads. All my crackheads are gone, man. Mm. All my crackheads are dead. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, yeah. Damn, we finna open the club up. We ain't got nobody. We gotta pay somebody now, okay? I know that sounds up, but dude.
They gone.
Dude, all of them died the same with heart attacks. Mm-hmm. That shit has a toll, or liver failure.
Yeah,
that shit has a toll. Takes a toll on your body. So as you get older, and if you don't abuse, I drink, but I got alcohol from the closing the Eve in 2019. So it's not a big deal for me. I'll smoke from time to time, but people give me weed, and I end up giving it away sometime because I ain't gonna burn up all that shit. So anything done in moderation, even exercise, man, I might not exercise in the gym 4 or 5 hours a day, but I do go and do something on the if it ain't but walk around my neighborhood, man. Keep your shit going. So when you get to this age, you ain't got to be bedridden or dealing with a lot of ailments. I take one pill a day, man, and dude. I enjoy myself, man. The best of my, I enjoy my grandkids. I let my cat my picture.
Yeah.
I'm gone. You still hear me though, right?
I still hear you. Yeah, the picture's gone. I don't know what happened, but we still hear you.
Okay. Anyway, man. So yeah, Doc, as I'm gone from the picture, y'all still got my, not with Alonzo up there. It's all to the good. Mm-hmm. Take care of yourself, folks. And hopefully one day you'll be a ripe old age and maybe look back. That old dude taught me something. Because everything I learned from old dudes, man. I ain't learned shit from no kids. I learned shit from kids now. I do TikTok. Instagram and social media shit. But when it came to life lessons, uh-huh. Gotta go to a head, Doc. You gotta go to an old head, man.
Yeah.
Gotta go
to old head. And thank you again. And let's talk soon. I don't know if you can see the camera right here, but
I do.
You see, this is my Black American Music Family Tree project right here. I'd like to, you know, link up with you and send you a poster or some of my artwork, really tracing Black American music back, and how everything branched off. I would love to, you know, to send you this.
I may need you to redo my flow chart, man. Shit.
Yeah, let's link up and then let's also talk about the comedy thing and everything we talked about. So
you got it. All right.
All right, so let's talk soon, man. Thank you again. I appreciate it.
All right, peace.
All right. Mm-hmm.